Folks, we want to welcome you all to On the Edge with K.A. Owens. I'm K.A. Owens, and we're broadcasting on 106.5 FM. Our antenna's on the top of the Habern Building in Louisville, Kentucky. So this is WFMP, and you are listening to On the Edge with K.A. Owens, and again, I'm K.A. Owens. So, folks, we're here with Reverend Don Cooley. Say hello to the people, Don.
Hey, people.
So this is Don's second appearance on our show, and thank you for coming back.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me back, K.A.
So I just mentioned that Don is trained in the ministry and was a Unitarian minister. And so tell us about your background and what all that means, how you came to the ministry.
Ooh, so that's an interesting question. I was raised in a Protestant tradition, and attended for a while a non-denominational evangelical fundamentalist congregation that told me I could and couldn't do certain things because I was a girl, and expected us to act in certain ways in the world that felt very constricting. And so when I went to college, I rebelled against all of that and found my own way and explored different religions and belief systems, because at heart I love church and I love gathering together for worship to find and scoop meaning in the world. It's just the old ways didn't work for me. When I graduated from college, I found the Unitarian Universalist Church, and my spouse and I started attending, and it wasn't long after that I heard a call to ministry, is what we call it, and went to seminary, got a Master's of Divinity degree, did a whole lot of reading and training, and became a Unitarian Universalist minister, and I served First Unitarian Church here in Louisville for just over 7 years.
So tell us, what is a Unitarian?
Oh, boy, that's a really big question. So my denomination, I work for my denomination now, is the Unitarian Universalist Association, and we're named after two different Protestant threads, the Unitarians and the Universalists. And the Unitarians believed in the unity of God, that that God is one. They didn't believe in the Trinity. And the Universalists believed in universal salvation, that God is love and that all people would eventually be reunited with God.
Goes to heaven?
So everybody goes to heaven, right.
All right.
And they argued over whether or not, you know, there would be sort of this time of suffering or there wouldn't be. But they believed that God is love. And the example they use is that God couldn't be any less loving than the most loving parent. And no parent is going to eternally damn their children to hell for eternity, right? Forever and ever and ever. No parent would do that. And God has to be better than even the best parent, was their understanding. So when the Unitarians and the Universalists got together in 1961 and created the Unitarian Universalist Association, they actually expanded it because it wasn't just focused on Christianity at that point. It was an understanding that of universalism with a lowercase u, and that there is truth and meaning to be found in a variety of different theological traditions. And so a Unitarian Universalist theologically could mean that somebody identifies as a Christian or as an atheist or as a pagan or a Buddhist or an agnostic or Jewish or so many other different things. So it's not the theology that brings Unitarian Universalists together in our congregations as much as it's our understanding that that it is our responsibility to create the beloved community, the world that we want to be. And we want that world to be one with full of faith and hope and love and justice and equality and equity. So
tell me something. In Louisville, we're broadcasting from Louisville, Kentucky. There are several churches that are thought of as social justice churches. One is First Unitarian, the other is Thomas Jefferson U, is where people in the church seem to have an interest in social justice. What's that all about?
Well, if one of the tenets of our faith is that we're all connected, and when you're connected to someone, you're going to want the best for them. And if we're all connected and we all want the best for everyone else, and if we don't necessarily, one of the things we don't have is this belief, a common belief in this God who makes things happen in the world. Some of us may be theist, but we're not going to believe in what I call the pointy finger God that answers one football team's prayers to win and doesn't answer another one's, or answers one person's prayer to put their cancer in remission, but doesn't answer someone else's. I don't. That's not the kind of divinity that most Unitarian Universalists believe in. So we believe that it is our responsibility to create the beloved community, and that we do that because we are all connected to one another, and it is our duty as human beings to seek a world of justice and equity.
Yes, in Louisville, there are a lot of social justice meetings held at First Unitarian. So a lot of people are familiar with going there for one thing
right.
or another. So are there any other academic fields of study that you've taken up?
So I am currently pursuing a master's in public administration from Indiana University. And it's interesting because it started because the way people go to and interact with congregations, with their religious congregations, has really changed in the last 20 years. And so I thought I would go and get this degree, and I would learn how nonprofits have been adjusting to these changes in giving, changes in volunteerism, and that I could then use that and bring it back to my work with congregations. And while that has been the case, what I'm also finding is this master's in public administration is opening my eyes and giving me a different understanding and a new understanding of what it means to be in public service and what the purposes of public organizations and how to run them and that sort of thing. And it's been fascinating. I'm just loving it.
So, so if you look at the world we live in now, is there a relationship in a good way between religion and public policy in this country today, or public administration? I mean, is there an ethical way? If you look at things are administered, for instance, in Kentucky, for maybe 10 years or more, the state legislature chose not to pay into the pension plans of its own employees. So you have one administration that, for instance, when Obamacare came along, they fully accepted, made the best out of it, and expanded Medicaid so that the working poor could have health insurance and get their teeth cleaned. And then you have the next election, the people came in, oh, well, we don't want to do that. Why do the working poor need health insurance? And it's interesting that the former, governor was not particularly religious, and the current governor is very, very, quote unquote, religious. And the religious person, just doesn't believe that the working poor deserve health care. So, and then, of course, In the election of 2016, evangelicals and the many elements of the religious community supported a person that was not particularly religious.
Right. Or that's an understatement.
not particularly righteous and just not that nice, but they felt like there are some goals that they could achieve. I think they had some kind of biblically thing they're saying that it's not necessarily a godly man can achieve God's will, implement God's will, something like that.
Right. Well, and I think that one of the things we're running into in this country is that what it means to be religious has been very narrowly defined by the right for a long time. And for a while, religious liberals and progressives didn't seem to protest that too much. But one of the things that I'm heartened to hear is Christian evangelicals who are progressive taking a stand and saying things like, this is not what I believe in. This is not what my religion teaches. This is not the religion of Jesus if they're Christian. And Christianity definitely dominates the marketplace in our country. You know, I think that part of the frustration is that, and maybe we touched on this last time, is a lack of humility, and understanding that a lack of understanding that religious liberty does not give me the right to impinge on someone else's religious liberty, right? Like this is the struggle. Well, Missouri is talking about this right now when it comes to the abortion debate, right? Is it the Church of Satan that is protesting the definition that life begins at conception and saying this is not what we believe, and therefore these laws against abortion are infringing on our religious liberty. Right.
There you go.
Right. So, and you know when the Church of Satan is doing something that's I don't even know what to label that. Interesting. So I think that the narrative about what it means to be religious has been dominated by a small fragment, and I think that that they have wanted to impose their specific brand of religion on other people, and that's not what this country is about. This country is about a plurality of beliefs and finding ways to navigate them together, whether you're a Christian or an evangelical Christian or a more mainline Christian or if you're Jewish or if you're agnostic or if you don't understand yourself as a person of faith at all, if you're an atheist or however you do it, we all have to find ways. And so if I can't impose my religious beliefs on you, and religious liberty doesn't mean that you can impose your religious faith beliefs on me.
So how does your faith affect something, let's say, feminism? That is, do you consider yourself to be a feminist? And what is feminism? And
that's such a loaded term, right? Because people.
President Trump said he wasn't one because right, he said right. That was going too far.
That was going too far. I think that I took this quiz online a few months ago, and it said that I was a Marxist feminist, and I'm not even honestly 100% sure what that means. But that's what it said I was. You know, I think that it's tough. I think that when you talk about feminism, there are different ways to talk about it. You know, there's the feminism of, so let's be clear. So Kay, you and I are having this conversation, and I'm a Gen X white woman, and you're a baby boomer black man, right? So we're having this conversation, and as we're having it, I'm so aware of how white women have co-opted the term feminist, right? And so do I define myself as feminist? That's a really tough question because there are many things that feminism historically and today are absolutely, like if being feminist believes that all women should have the same opportunities as men, then yes, absolutely I'm a feminist. If being feminist means that I somehow uphold the white woman experience as normative and all women should have the same experience, then no, that's not where I go with it.
Well, Gloria Steinem once wrote that she felt that white women, well, are women... had as much power, social power, as men through high school and college. But after college, that's when she was coming up, the status, economic power, so on and so forth of women depended on the man they married. So that's what she said. And so we're deriving from that, Betty Friedan's version of feminism was, white women need to get careers.
Right.
So because, there was the book, The Feminine Mystique, and then what the Feminine Mystique was all about was that in the 50s, because of the labor-saving devices and because of the economy at the time, the white man could get a job and he can support. He could get a house in the suburbs. The wife didn't have to work. He could send the kids to college and have at least one car to drive, maybe two, maybe like a newish one and a used one. So the Feminine Mystique was, and it was written about, white women were just bored out of their gourds.
Right.
Because you had these really intelligent, some well-educated white women who, you know, there were just, you know, nothing wrong with being a homemaker, but with the labor-saving devices and not having to pump water out of the well and walk a mile to get the fresh water, you know, and so, and all this kind of stuff. So white women just bored out of their gourds, and they were laying down in the bed and going into a coma, and so being treated, and so, you know, they were just bored. So, but the answer to the feminine mystique was women to get out in the world and have careers and be equal to men.
Well, and remember, they weren't just bored,
yeah.
Right? Like, they were also extremely frustrated, which is why
exactly.
Mother's Little Helper, right? And the use of Valium was so prevalent among white women was because their aspirations were being actively suppressed. Right. And in this way, like, so this is where I go with all of that is I don't think you can separate white supremacy from patriarchy. All right. Because what ends up happening is that it's patriarchy and white supremacy that that led women to believe or led society to tell women that they had a certain role to fill and they weren't allowed to break out of that mold. Right. And it was also patriarchy and white supremacy that tell men that they're not allowed to be emotional creatures. Right. That women are emotional and men are not allowed to be emotional and to critique a guy and say like, oh, don't cry like a girl or you throw like a girl. That's always an insult. Right. That's patriarchy and white supremacy all tied in because we're othering someone and we're using this white male experience as what's normative and what we're supposed to be like, right? But I don't want to be like that. You know, I don't want to be this unfeeling, driven person who can't find any sort of sustenance in the world outside of my career, right? And that my career is going to define me. And so that's the limitation, I think, of saying go out and find careers. Well, no, that's then conforming to telling women to conform to sort of this white male ideal of the way we're supposed to be. And I think that one of the things that my generation has been dealing with is that we have choice, right? Like, we don't have to go out and have careers. Maybe we do want to stay home with our families, or maybe we have careers for a little bit of time, or maybe we, you know, maybe we don't even have careers. Maybe we work at jobs, or maybe we do public service, or maybe there are different things. There are so many other ways of moving in the world.
So then affirmative action comes along, female activists, you know, they say, hey, this is an opportunity. We need to get in on this. White female activists. You can't blame them, but the affirmative action was designed for the descendants of African slaves. That's what it was created for.
Right.
So you look at it today, the majority of the benefits of affirmative action go to white women.
Right.
Jobs, minority contracts,
yep.
Scholarships, the whole deal. And so here's a program that was designed for the descendants of slaves and of African slaves, and they don't receive the benefits of it
right.
at all. And so you kind of look around and you wonder, for instance, during slavery, black women raped every day by the slave master, raped every day. Sally Hemings, 14-year-old slave concubine of the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, rape not an issue. Nobody cares. The only reason there's any tint of homophobia in the black community today is because not only were the black women raped by the white slave masters in slavery, but the black men, the black little boys, they were raped as well. So, but still, rape not an issue.
Right.
Nobody cares. So, coming up to recent history, black folk feel like, hey, we're in a national moment around police brutality with the Take a Knee and Colin Kaepernick. And so that's the discussion. And then white women with, legitimate grievances sort of change the topic to sexual harassment and sexual assault, basically, of high-powered white women. Right. I mean, so it's like white women who live in mansions, they're upset.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the ways that I understand that, too, is...
And that moment shifts.
And that moment shifts, right? And that moment shifts in part because we're still more comfortable talking about women's issues and issues of feminism than we are talking about race issues and issues around black bodies being beaten and killed by police and people in power, right? We feel, and by we, I'm talking about white women, we feel more comfortable saying that this is how we're oppressed and using that as a way of understanding and having empathy for other people who are oppressed. But what ends up happening is we then steal the moment because the press then goes with the white women rather than sticking with the protest.
And so then you have the question is, you know, looking at it from people of color point of view, would we be better off under white female leadership than white male leadership? I mean, 53% of white women voted for Trump. 60% of white women voted for Judge Roy Moore in Alabama. So the question is, would people of color be better off under white female leadership? And if so, why?
You know, there's a saying that when the level of water rises, all the boats rise too. And I suspect that under, not all, but many... the leadership of many white women, there would be a small raise in the level of water for everyone. But I don't think it would necessarily be anywhere near what is needed in this country. I don't think that, you know, maybe I'm a radical, but I don't think most of our politicians go anywhere near far enough identifying ways that we need to equal the opportunities for people of color. I mean, you're not going to fix generation upon generation of oppression by one program or by one leader or by one solution. It's not enough.
Well, it's like, I kind of like Elizabeth Warren, but Sarah Palin, I'm not so sure.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah, it really depends, right? White women aren't monolithic either. Although, you know, we've got some work to do, man. I mean, we've got, you know, one of the things that happens a lot is when white women talk about, when we engage in a conversation around race, we end up talking about feminism and our own experiences as women. And on the one hand, that's good because our own experiences give us insight to a degree of what people of color experience, but only to a degree. And without that humility and curiosity around, okay, where does that stop? You know, how we tend to take the conversation and kind of steer it towards what we're more comfortable with. And that's one of the things that I think we as white women, not that I can speak for all white women, but this is one of the things that I think we really need to work on.
So again, here we are. It just so happens that this is 2018, and the president has just sort of delivered his technically his first State of the Union. So, kind of, where are we? Where are we going?
My goodness, I have no idea. Do you know? Do you know where we're going? I mean, in so many ways, it feels like we're going backwards, and yet there are these signs of hope.
Well, tons of women have signed up to run for office in
right?
Kentucky and all across the country.
But that's not. I mean, that's good.
Yeah, I'm just a note.
Right.
I'm trying to look for something positive here.
Right.
So there's that.
I think I see a lot of people who are engaged in politics in a way that they weren't before. I think that there are a lot of people who are becoming, I think one of the things that is happening is people are becoming more aware of problems that are not new, but that have existed and that are now being viewed publicly for maybe the first time for some people. I mean, a lot of people really believed after Obama was elected that that was the end of racism in this country, which is, you know, just incredibly naive and shows a small worldview and experience, right? And so now people are seeing, whoa, look, we have these major issues that we didn't even necessarily know existed, we being, again, white people.
So I don't think that economic inequality is being challenged at all.
No.
I see that the current administration intends to sabotage solar power to try to prop up coal.
I saw that.
Can't possibly be good.
Well, and the president called it beautiful, clean coal in his State of the Union, which is so short-sighted.
And as if that kind of talk will actually help people in coal country.
Right.
Of course it will not. I've listened to a Supreme Court discussion on C-SPAN, and what they're talking about, you know, they're all lawyers on the Supreme Court, and so they don't believe that lawyers know better than the client, even in criminal cases. So the question is whether or not the client has the right to tell his or her own story, or does his defense attorney have the right? And so where they're leaning is, well, you can fire your attorney, but the attorney is in charge of the case. And so it's a death penalty case. The defendant claims that, one, he has an alibi, he wasn't there, it was a setup for the police, and his defense attorney, well, that's just preposterous. And so the Supreme Court is debating whether or not a defendant has a right to tell his or her own story. Well, here's the thing. It's not preposterous that the person has an alibi or that the police falsified evidence, because all these things have happened before. So
absolutely.
I don't know why it's so preposterous, and why would the defense attorney be able to decide that it's preposterous? So,
well, and keep in mind, too, that a lot of times the defense attorney, if it's one that's court-appointed, they're not necessarily as invested in the case. I mean, Brian Stevenson recounts case after case of defense attorneys not doing their job in his book, Just Mercy, and clients and people dying, people getting put to death because the defense attorney didn't do their job.
Exactly. So the debate is now, in the ongoing case, whether or not essentially the United States is going to allow a defendant to essentially be faced with two prosecutors, one hired by the state and one his own attorney acting as a second prosecutor. So economic inequality not being fixed, criminal justice system not being fixed. So
immigration system not being fixed.
Exactly.
And not only not being fixed, but the proposal last night sounded like it's going to pit dreamers against their parents, right? Like if they're building a wall and trying as in return for DACA, right? How is that going to work out?
So folks, we never run out of things to talk with.
No, we don't.
Reverend Don Cooley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.